Their escort of trucks just behind flashes turn signals. Five pull into the truck parking area just across from the small brick building. Two of the trucks stop on the entrance ramp that's blocking it. While Jim and Ed are in the men's room, six drivers scurry across the frozen parking lot and silently position themselves outside the restroom door. When they hear blow dryers, they nod and ready themselves. First, Jim walks out and is grabbed by three of the truckers. One quickly duct tapes his mouth shut while one clamps his arm firmly around Jim's neck, whispering, "Relax, kid. Keep squirming and I'll break this skinny little neck of yours." The third trucker quickly binds Jim's hands behind him with more duct tape, and then all three quietly drag him out into the dimly lit parking area. Unawares, Ed now exits the men's room and is likewise bound and gagged. Both Ed and Jim are jumped into the trailer of one of the empty trucks, the one whose drivers recognize them. One of the drivers looks into the trailer before he slams and latches the door and says, "You fuckers killed some friends of mine the other day back on I-29, just so you know. You took some shots at me and my partner, too. Now we're going to even the score. Say your prayers, guys. This night's going to be your last." He slams the tall metal door with a clang. They hear the latches attached to a rod the length of the door slide into place. Outside, they hear the crunch of the driver's boots on the snow as he walks around to the tractor. The tractor door slams and the air brakes wheeze. The big diesel roars and the truck lurches forward. The other trucks have begun to roll west, too. There's some comments on the CBs, but mainly it's a silent convoy heading into the empty spaces of western Nebraska and eastern Wyoming. At the I-80 I-79 split, all but one truck heads south on I-79 towards Denver. The lone truck remaining goes west onto the deserted stretch of I-80 towards Cheyenne. Jim and Ed writhe in its otherwise empty trailer. Ed and Jim manage to squirm around until with their free fingers they manage to rip the duct tapes off their mouths, leaving their faces scarred with bloody red welts, which in the darkness they do not see but certainly feel. Jim says to Ed, "Man, I'm scared. Where the hell are they taking us? Out in the middle of nowhere, then shoot us, I guess. Can you try to pull the duct tape off my hands? They'd wrapped it around about 10 times and I could barely feel my fingers in this cold." After some more squirming and rolling about, Ed says, "No way. I can't find the start of it. There's too many loops to rip. Try mine. It's no use. There's nothing I can do. At least let's pull together. Must be fucking minus 30 in here." They huddle together in silence, trying to conserve body heat, knowing that it probably won't matter much longer. Just inside Wyoming, the truck pulls off the interstate onto an old state route heading north. The outline yellow trailer lights are cut, and just the headlights and small red taillights are visible. Finally, miles from the interstate and many miles from any settlement, the truck stops. Moonlight bathes the snow-covered rolling high prairie. A few small dark clumps of trees can be seen here and there in the distance. The drivers get out and open the rear of their trailer. Jim and Ed are huddled next to each other in the sub-zero cold. As one driver climbs up into the trailer, dim lights on the trailer's roof switch on. He grabs Ed and Jim by their coat collars and drags them towards the rear opening. His partner is waiting on the ground with a handgun pointed at them. The guy on the truck takes out a knife and slits the duct tape binding their arms and legs, then slips it back into a sheath attached to his wide leather belt. He hops down. His partner pulls another handgun from his belt and hands it to him. They both stand back and one says, "Okay, you two, out of the trailer." They jump to the ground. Ed stumbles and lands on his hands on the cold, icy road surface, cutting his palms in several places. He quickly stands up, folding his arms and placing his hands under his armpit. Jim starts whimpering. The driver slams and bolts the door. One of the drivers laughs and turns to his partner and says, "They're not as tough without a gun in their hands shooting the tires out from under a 56-year-old guy with a wife and three kids, are they?" "I guess not." Jim says, "You can't do this. It's cold-blooded murder. You'll hang for this. You won't get away with it." One trucker laughs and says to the other, "You know, he has a point. Do they still hang people in Wyoming? Maybe we should let them go." "It's okay with me. It's up to you guys. Do you want to go?" "Yeah," says Jim, not understanding where this is leading to. "All right, you guys. You start running. You got until I count to 20 before we start shooting." Jim looks quickly at Ed and they both start running back down the deserted road away from the truck while one of the drivers calls out the numbers slowly until they both start laughing. Both truckers head back to the idling tractor and, in a burst of soot, clanking gears and the roar of the diesel, it resumes its trip north. One of the drivers says to the other as Jim and Ed recede in the rearview mirrors, "If they're lucky, maybe their bodies will be found by spring thaw." The other laughs. The engine grinds, gears rattle, and air brakes chatter. The truck rumbles off into the distance. Jim and Ed stop running and turn and stand watching its red taillights fade in the frigid, moonlit, snow-covered wasteland. Jim looks at Ed, shivering, and says, "Shit, I thought they were going to do it." "What now?" Ed says, pointing south. "That way, I guess. Must be the way back to the interstate." And they begin silently walking south. After about a mile, Ed looks to one side and, placing his hand across Jim's chest, freezes with terror and says one word, "Wolves." Panicked, they look about them and see on either side of the road, in the pale moonlight, six slowly moving moving dark shapes spaced at even intervals about 100 yards away. Then ahead of them, the largest faces them on the road, the red-eyed alpha male. Ed and Jim clutch at one another, gripped in total fear. There's nowhere to hide, no trees, no phone poles, no branches to make weapons from. Their nervous motion only emboldens the hungry pack. Then the alpha male ahead of them howls and lurches forward. The entire pack attacks. Jim and Ed are dead within seconds. Just bones and shreds of torn clothes and blood-stained snow remain by morning. The tracks of the 18-wheeler are long since scoured away by the constant wind. Crows pick through the bone pile. As Ed and Jim meet their end, it's just about 10 o'clock, dinner time on the prairie, party time in Omaha. The next day, a passing pickup truck will spot the kill zone. Not unusual in these parts, the driver knows. Lots of deer don't make it through the winter. But he knows this wasn't a deer when he sees a human skull by the side of the road being picked at by a huge black crow. Normally, this is the sort of story that makes gruesome headlines on the cable news networks, but other events that night diminish its impact. It'll be several weeks before Ed and Jim's remains are identified and linked to several arrest warrants for various crimes in several states. The coroner rules that the death was caused by the wolves, but no one can come up with an explanation as to why they were alone on that stretch of highway in the middle of the night. The small bits of duct tape recovered a few hundred yards away lead to suspicions, but given their criminal record, there was little interest in wasting Laramie County resources pursuing the investigation further. Case closed. No one claims their gnawed remains, which, after a year, will be buried unmarked in the county cemetery. Time, 8:30 p.m. At 8:30, Tom and Sean go back to Joe's warehouse. They park Lance's SUV a block away. Tom opens the door and they quickly enter. Sean resumes his position in the back of the van and Tom reattaches the cable ties to his wrists and ankles. Lance expects that Joe will want the driver checked when he returns. Tom retreats up to the second floor, which overlooks the garage area below. He finds a small folding chair, disappears into the shadows, and waits to release Sean once Joe, Mark, and Sid have returned and checked their captive driver. Sean has a sharp knife concealed in his rear pocket, just in case. At about 9:30, Joe arrives at the warehouse and parks his car in the lot across the street as usual. Mark and Sid pull in at the same time. They cross the dark and deserted street with the wind howling from the west and the wind chills something unspeakable. Joe says, "I figure the top floor is the best place since we're only about 2 miles from Mulroan as the crow flies, and there are no tall buildings in between to block the view." "We brought some beer and chips," says Sid, holding up a plastic bag. "Might as well enjoy the show." At this point, Joe doesn't give a damn, but the prospect of seeing that club gone heartens him. Now he can go back to his real calling, selling dope. He says to Mark, "Go check on the driver, will you?" A moment later, Mark returns and says, "Just as we left him." "Good. Let's get upstairs. We don't want to miss Jack's big phone call." They take the freight elevator up to the sixth floor and head down a corridor to a dark corner office that faces north towards Mulroan. The only light in the room is from the corridor. They pull up some chairs and face a low windowsill, looking out over the industrial outskirts of Omaha. On the south side of Joe's warehouse are hundreds of acres of railway staging yards. Omaha is still a major freight junction. The only lights are street lights, an occasional neon sign, and the headlights of a passing freight headed out onto the high prairie. Tom quietly opens the van door and cuts the cable ties. He and Sean slip out the side door and run to Lance's SUV parked a block away. They hop in and drive quickly back to the club. At Mulroan, Lance invites the crowd at David's apartment to go to the south-facing picture window and wait for an event of some interest. Mary says, "It's better be good, honey." Lance says, "Oh, I think you'll like it. Just look to the southwest." Mark and Sid drink beer and snack on the bag of chips. Joe pulls out a quarter liter of whiskey and takes a short swig, saying, "Okay, I guess it's time, guys." He double-checks the time on his cell phone, then punches Jack's number in and hits talk. Jack answers and, seeing the caller ID, says, "Are you in position?" "Yeah, Jack, we're here. Anytime you're ready." "All right, I've punched in the phone number. Another 30 seconds and it will be exactly 10 o'clock, then I'll hit talk." The seconds tick by. Joe wonders why he's here. How would Jack know if he weren't? Then Jack says, "Okay, I'm hitting talk now. Let me know what happens next." Through fiber optics, the deadly signal flashes from St. Louis to Omaha. Phase-locked loops in the small receiver in the black rubber tube capture a radio signal. Small semiconductor chips decode its content. It recognizes its ID. It responds. Incoming call. Semiconductor gates latch. The ringer activates. The detonator does too. And milliseconds later, so do three kegs of RDX.